Now we turn to Bill Resnick and Sharon Grant.
Hi, folks. Recently, I began looking for writing on black history and the black experience in the United States of North America. I was looking for writing that vividly did two things. First, to examine the persistence of racism and how it was manifested for the last 400 years. And second, to examine continued black struggle and vividly and accessibly show how important it was, not just in making black gains, but also in shaping this country, the best of this country, in fact, to make it more free, just, democratic, and culturally rich. Of course, with a long way to go towards justice and democracy. I was looking for one writer. I found a group of writers, a group of black journalists, most from the New York Times, who used the tremendous volume of literature, including slave narratives, personal and family histories, academic work by historians, and they produced what amounts to a short book. It filled the whole issue of the New York Times Sunday Magazine. It was led by a woman, Nicole Hannah-Jones, who wrote a number of the sections and one wonderful essay. You'll hear excerpts from that essay today. Its title is, "Our Democracy's Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written. Black Americans Have Fought to Make Them True." So I tried to get an interview with her, but she's enormously in demand with Pulitzer and MacArthur Prizes. So today I'm joined by Sharon Grant, an African-American woman from Brooklyn and Chicago, and has strangely enough lived in Portland longer than either of those places. She's been a community health worker and health educator for Multnomah County for over 20 years. She has a great voice, has sung a lot, done pro bono publico, voiceovers for videos, and we're going to bring Nicole Hannah-Jones's essay to you. So, hello, Sharon Grant. Welcome to KABU.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me. I hope this program encourages listeners to read the New York Times Magazine article you mentioned. It's called 1619, and it can be found at nytimes.com/1619, and aims to show a more accurate history of America. And the 1619 Project comes out of that work that they did.
So, Sharon, let's begin.
Okay. My dad always flew an American flag in our front yard. The blue paint on our two-story house was perennially chipping. The fence, or the rail by the stairs, or the front door existed in a perpetual state of disrepair. But that flag always flew pristine. Our corner lot, which had been redlined by the federal government, was along the river that divided the black side from the white side of our Iowa town. At the edge of our lawn, high on an aluminum pole, soared the flag, which my dad would replace as soon as it showed the slightest tatter. My dad was born into a family of sharecroppers on a white plantation in Greenwood, Mississippi, where black people bent over cotton from can't see in the morning to can't see at night, just as their enslaved ancestors had done not long before. The Mississippi of my dad's youth was an apartheid state that subjugated its near-majority black population through breathtaking acts of violence. White residents in Mississippi lynched more black people than those in any other state in the country, and the white people in my dad's home county lynched more black residents than those in any other county in Mississippi, often for such crimes as entering a room occupied by white women, bumping into a white girl, or trying to start a sharecropper's union. My dad's mother, like all the black people in Greenwood, could not vote, use the public library, or find work other than toiling in the cotton fields or toiling in white people's houses. So in the 1940s, she packed up her few belongings and her three small children and joined the flood of black Southerners fleeing north. She got off the Illinois Central Railroad in Waterloo, Iowa, only to have her hopes of the mythical promised land shattered when she learned that Jim Crow did not end at the Mason-Dixon line. Grandmama, as we called her, found a house in a segregated black neighborhood on the city's east side and then found the work that was considered black women's work no matter where black women lived, cleaning white people's houses. Dad, too, struggled to find promise in this land. In 1962, at age 17, he signed up for the Army. Like many young men, he joined in hopes of escaping poverty, but he went into the military for another reason as well, a reason common to black men. Dad hoped that if he served his country might finally treat him as an American. The Army did not end up being his way out. He was passed over for opportunities, his ambition stunted. He would be discharged under murky circumstances and then labor in a series of service jobs for the rest of his life. Like all the black men and women in my family, he believed in hard work. But like all the black men and women in my family, no matter how hard he worked, he never got ahead. So when I was young, that flag outside our home never made sense to me. How could this black man, having seen firsthand the way his country abused black Americans, how it refused to treat us as full citizens, proudly fly this banner? I didn't understand his patriotism. It deeply embarrassed me. I had been taught in school, through cultural osmosis, that the flag wasn't really ours, that our history as a people began with enslavement, and that we had contributed little to this great nation. It seemed that the closest thing black Americans could have to cultural pride was to be found in our vague connection to Africa, a place we had never been. That my dad felt so much honor in being an American felt like a marker of his degradation, his acceptance of our subordination. Like most young people, I thought I understood so much when in fact I understood so little. My father knew exactly what he was doing when he raised that flag. He knew that our people's contributions to building the richest and most powerful nation in the world were indelible, that the United States simply would not exist without us. Before the abolishment of the international slave trade, 400,000 enslaved Africans would be sold into America. Those individuals and their descendants transformed the lands to which they'd been brought into some of the most successful colonies in the British Empire. Through back-breaking labor, they cleared the land across the southeast. They taught the colonists to grow rice. They grew and picked the cotton that, at the height of the slavery, was the nation's most valuable commodity, accounting for half of all American exports and 66% of the world's supply. They built the plantations of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison, sprawling properties that today attract thousands of visitors from across the globe, captivated by the history of the world's greatest democracy. They laid the foundations of the White House and the Capitol, even placing with their unfree hands the Statue of Freedom atop the Capitol Dome. They lugged the heavy wooden tracks of the railroads that crisscrossed the South and that helped take the cotton they picked to the northern textile mills, fueling the Industrial Revolution. They built vast fortunes for white people north and south. At one time, the second richest man in the nation was a Rhode Island slave trader. Profits from black people's stolen labor helped the young nation pay off its war debts and financed some of our most prestigious universities. It was the relentless buying, selling, insuring, and financing of their bodies and the products of their labor that made Wall Street a thriving banking, insurance, and trading sector, and New York City the financial capital of the world. But it would be historically inaccurate to reduce the contributions of black people to the vast material wealth created by our bondage. Black Americans have also been, and continue to be, foundational to the idea of American freedom. More than any other group in this country's history, we have served, generation after generation, in an overlooked but vital role. It is we who have been the perfecters of this democracy.
The vast limitations of U.S. democracy, actually in many ways a democracy for the few, is discussed later in the project. The project, again, is titled 1619, the year the first slaves were brought to this country and promptly sold for good money to the pirates, who had themselves stolen them from a Portuguese slave trading ship. This 20-some were the first of many millions brought to the Americas. The essay, whose introduction was read by Sharon Grant, is part of a New York Times credit to them, actually. It's part of a series that will become a book and continuously growing website called 1619. The next section of this essay is about the nation's hypocrisy, but it begins with Nicole Hannah-Jones' overall view of the black contribution to this country's always resisted and still imperfect, to say the least, political and social democracy. Indeed, each democratic turn fought for from below was followed by elite machinations, also at least with some success, machinations to regain dominance.
The United States is a nation founded on both an ideal and a lie. Our Declaration of Independence, approved on July 4, 1776, proclaims that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. But the white men who drafted those words did not believe them to be true for the hundreds of thousands of black people in their midst. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness did not apply to fully one-fifth of the country. Yet despite being violently denied the freedom and justice promised to all, black Americans believed fervently in the American creed. Through centuries of black resistance and protest, we have helped the country live up to its founding ideals, and not only for ourselves. Black rights struggles paved the way for every other rights struggle, including women's and gay rights, immigrant and disability rights. Without the idealistic, strenuous, and patriotic efforts of black Americans, our democracy today would most likely look very different. It might not be a democracy at all.
We have walked through the shadows of death. We had to walk all by ourselves. But we'll never turn back until we have all been free. Until we have all been freed.
That was Mavis Staples, We'll Never Turn Back, and this is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour with Sharon Grant. She's presenting excerpts, a greeting from an essay by Nicole Hannah-Jones on black struggle and its immense contributions to the shaping of this country. Sharon Grant, in the next section, Nicole Hannah-Jones discussed the never-resolved contradictions of two of this country's most revered figures. Thomas Jefferson and the Founding Fathers, as history calls them, were revered for their democratic ideals and commitments. But whereas Nicole Hannah-Jones, and many scholars have shown, they were deeply infected by racist ideas. This, of course, has continued to the present, as has the fight back against white patriarchal rule, and always led by black struggle, that from the Civil War amendments to the Constitution and the civil rights legislation of the 1960s.
In June 1776, Thomas Jefferson sat at his portable writing desk in a rented room in Philadelphia and penned these words: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." For the last 243 years, this fierce assertion of the fundamental and natural rights of humankind to freedom and self-governance has defined our global reputation as a land of liberty. As Jefferson composed his expiring words, however, a teenage boy who would enjoy none of those rights and liberties waited nearby to serve at his master's beck and call. His name was Robert Hemings, and he was the half-brother of Jefferson's wife, born to Martha Jefferson's father and a woman he owned. It was common for white enslavers to keep their half-black children in slavery. Jefferson had chosen Hemings from among about 130 enslaved people that worked on the forced labor camp he called Monticello to accompany him to Philadelphia and ensure his every comfort as he drafted the text making the case for a new democratic republic based on the individual rights of men. At the time, one-fifth of the population within the 13 colonies struggled under a brutal system of slavery unlike anything that had existed in the world before. Chattel slavery was not conditional, but racial. It was heritable and permanent, not temporary, meaning generations of black people were born into it and passed their enslaved status onto their children. Enslaved people were not recognized as human beings, but as property that could be mortgaged, traded, bought, sold, used as collateral, given as a gift, and disposed of violently. Jefferson's white colonists knew that black people were human beings, but they created a network of laws and customs, astounding for both their precision and cruelty, that ensured that enslaved people would never be treated as such. As the abolitionist William Goodell wrote in 1853, quote, "If anything founded on falsehood might be called a science, we might add the system of American slavery to the list of strict sciences," unquote. Jefferson and the other founders were keenly aware of this hypocrisy. And so in Jefferson's original draft of the Declaration of Independence, he tried to argue that it wasn't the colonists' fault. Instead, he blamed the King of England for forcing the institution of slavery on the unwilling colonists and called the tracking in human beings a crime. Yet neither Jefferson nor most of the founders intended to abolish slavery, and in the end, they struck that passage out. There is no mention of slavery in the final Declaration of Independence. Similarly, 11 years later, when it came time to draft the Constitution, the framers carefully constructed a document that preserved and protected slavery without ever using the word. In the texts in which they were making the case for freedom to the world, they did not want to explicitly enshrine their hypocrisy, so they sought to hide it. The Constitution contains 84 clauses. 6 deal directly with slavery, as the historian David Wallstriker has written, and 5 more hold implications for slavery. The Constitution protected the property of those who enslaved black people, prohibited the federal government from intervening to end the importation of enslaved Africans for a term of 20 years, allowed Congress to mobilize militia to put down insurrections by the enslaved, and forced states that had outlawed slavery to turn over enslaved people who had run away seeking refuge. Like many others, the writer and abolitionist Samuel Bryan called out the deceit, saying of the Constitution, quote, "The words are dark and ambiguous, such as no plain man of common sense would have used, and are evidently chosen to conceal from Europe that in this enlightened country, the practice of slavery has its advocates among men in the highest stations," unquote. The Supreme Court enshrined this thinking in the law in its 1857 Dred Scott decision, ruling that black people, whether enslaved or free, came from a slave race. This made them inferior to white people and therefore incompatible with American democracy. Democracy was for citizens, and the Negro race, the court ruled, was, quote, "a separate class of persons," unquote, which the founders had, quote, "not regarded as a portion of the people or citizens of the government and had no rights which white man was bound to respect," unquote. This belief that black people were not merely enslaved but were a slave race became the root of the endemic racism that we still cannot purge from this nation to this day. If black people could not ever be citizens, if they were a caste apart from all other humans, then they did not require the rights bestowed by the Constitution, and so the "we" in "we the people" was a lie.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host. With Bill Resnick playing a support role, that was Sharon Grant reading excerpts from an essay by Nicole Hannah-Jones titled, "Our Democracy's Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written. Black Americans Have Fought to Make Them True." On next week's Old Mole, Sharon Grant will read more excerpts from the second half of that essay. They'll include reflections on smashed hopes of integration after black Americans returned from World War II, continuing black struggles generating the civil rights movement, which changed this country with considerable benefits for women, the disabled, and sexual minorities, but not as much to this day for blacks themselves.